At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Bevin Lannis is a mother, survivor, and victim advocate from New York. Bevin joins us today to share about her daughter Megan's journey, as well as to bring awareness to domestic violence. In these two episodes, Bevin candidly shares about the immense trauma Megan was forced to face in her youth and the harmful path she was launched down as a result. Devastatingly, Megan's young life was stolen on October 23, 2021, after experiencing years of violence. In the wake of her loss, Bevin has made it her mission to advocate for victims by amplifying what she calls Meggie's voice. The Broken Cycle Media team is eternally appreciative of Bevin's honesty, advocacy, and her desire to change the future for those who experience violence at the hands of a loved one. This episode is dedicated in loving memory of Megan Kiefer.
My name is Bevin Lannis. I live in New York on Long Island. I am the mom of four children. I am a domestic violence advocate. I am one of six children. My parents divorced when I was in fourth or fifth grade. My father remarried a wonderful woman. I was about 12 years old when they remarried. They had three children together, so that's where the six come in. They lived in Connecticut and then settled again in Massachusetts on Cape Cod. We stayed here on Long Island. My sister and my mother, my brother stayed with us and then moved in with my father, my stepmother in high school. My childhood was okay. It had its own trauma. My mother was an alcoholic, so I grew up in that environment. When I was 17 in my senior year, I met a boy who had graduated a year before me. We did not run in the same social circles, but we wound up dating. I wound up moving out of my house when I graduated high school and moving in with him. We got married in 1989. I was 19 years old. I stayed with him. Our marriage was definitely falling apart. He never actually put his hands on me, but the holes in the walls, the screaming, the yelling, and the alcohol. I wound up being pregnant with Megan. I was 25 when I had her. He and I split up a year after she was born because I wasn't doing that anymore with her. He terminated his parental rights when she was five. I met my husband when she was two. My husband, we're married 25 years. He's a great guy. We had three children together, but he raised Megan and he loved her like she was his own. I think I haven't fully processed the trauma. I like to describe that I keep my grief in a box, and it's a white box with a red sparkly ribbon, and it's up on a shelf because if I unpack it, it's very emotional. Megan loved dogs. We got her a dog for Christmas when she was eight, and she named him Elvis because it came from Santa Claus and the elves. She was a foodie. She loved Justin Bieber. He was big when she was a teenager, so that was her music guy. whenever I get in my car and Justin Bieber's on the radio, and it's usually the song I have a video of her singing with her friend that's on. I always say it's a sign from her. She did some cheerleading. She loved volleyball. This boy that, I don't know if they were junior high boyfriend girlfriends or they were just starting to talk, but in between eighth grade and ninth grade, he wound up passing away in a car accident. She had a great circle of girlfriends. She went to high school and it started fine. It's hard as a parent. You want them to socialize and have fun, but you're always nervous. In 10th grade, she met this girl. I tried to trust my daughter and her judgment, but that friendship actually is what started Megan's downward spiral. She took her to a party. My daughter was roofied and gang raped. We didn't know about for years. She didn't tell us. Maybe a year after it happened, she started having mental health crises. We wound up doing counseling and therapy, running the gamut of medications and therapies. But she was also going down a course of conduct that was putting her in danger. The people she was with could very well potentially harm her. We really did try everything. We disconnected the internet in our home so she couldn't go on the internet. That was back in the day of MySpace. One of the incidents, it was her sister's birthday, and we get a phone call at like 5 in the morning from the MTA police, and they're in Jamaica, Queens. They're telling us that Megan's there. Megan was about 16 at the time, and I'm like, you can't possibly have her there. She's home asleep in her bedroom, and I go in her bedroom and she's not there. So my husband went and got her. What had happened was she had broke through the firewalls on the school's internet system and accessed MySpace and met some guy, snuck out of our house in the middle of the night. We had alarmed our home because she had been sneaking out. I don't know if she figured it out on her own or someone told her to deactivate one and tape it to the other one so you could open the window and nobody would know. This is January 31st, so it's freezing cold. Walks to the train station, which was probably a 45-minute walk for her. Gets on the train to go meet some guy in Jamaica, Queens. He was not there. She wound up meeting someone else at the train station, hanging out and smoking pot with him. And those were the situations that she was putting herself in. I believe that was when we did her first hospitalization after that incident. The first time we took her for a hospitalization, they were like, well, she's not suicidal, so we can't admit her. And I'm like, but she is suicidal. She's around people who are harming her and could kill her. So I would say that is suicidal. My mother had an obsession with my daughter. That was her best friend. And there came a point in time where we had to draw boundaries when Megan was in high school and we were in and out of hospitals. One of the boundaries is that she could not have contact with my mother. My mother walked away from all four of my children. If she couldn't see her, she didn't want to see any of them. She had spent her senior year at a residential school in upstate New York. It was for girls who had emotional and mental health issues. She seemed to enjoy it. She actually made friends with some girls there that she stayed friends with until she died. It definitely helped her because it took her out of the element that was down here. She graduated and she came home. In the beginning, when I talked about her and shared her story, I didn't share her traumas. And then recently I started sharing them because I'm like, if I don't share them, it's like doing an injustice to her because her traumas are part of who she is. My daughter, she's been raped more than the first time. She was trafficked. She's been robbed at gunpoint. She's been held against her will in situations. All kinds of things happened to her. Even through all of that, she still had love to give, where most people would maybe become bitter and jaded. She internalized a lot of it, but she had a lot of love to give. Our relationship would be up and down. Sometimes I would go weeks without hearing from her when she was living a lifestyle that I had to keep away from her younger siblings. The people she had been involved with down here were gang related. which is the other reason I had to protect my other children and protect my family from that element. And that would be hard if she was doing things that were dangerous to herself. But she always knew I loved her. She would call me, she would yell at me, and then she'd call me the next day and everything would be fine. I was like a safe space for her to unleash. But I had to exercise tough love, and that was hard. I didn't want it like that. Shortly after she turned 18, she moved out and moved in with my mother. But it didn't work out so well for her. My mother was mean, and I believe it contributed to some of Megan's issues. And then she bounced around after that. Various jobs. She had spent some time down in Georgia, some brief time in Florida, some time in Seattle, time upstate, then down on Long Island. She had gone to school to be a medical assistant. She had a hard time because she couldn't pass the test. I think she took it twice, failed it, and she just got discouraged and didn't want to take it again. And then she got a job at Roto-Rooter doing office stuff. And she was proud of herself. She was able to get her own first apartment. It was like $800 a month. By New York standards, that's incredibly cheap. It was a one bedroom, one bathroom, small apartment on top of an old storefront. She was so excited. I helped her get some furnishings for the apartment. She loved it. We would try therapy and then the therapist would be leaving that practice and go to another therapist. And it got to the point, understandably, that she didn't want to go because every time you start a new therapist, you have to relive the trauma. And she didn't want to do that. I kept her on my insurance until she was 26. That way, if she ever wanted to go and try and unpack everything, because by this time she's 26, she had 11 years of abusive relationships, 11 years of horrific things happening to her. Some that I had known about and some I didn't know about until afterwards. She couldn't unpack all of that. So for her, I think it was just easier to try and fix someone else. And if she fixed them, maybe they would love her and not hurt her. I had an interview recently with a psychologist and he had done a book on why men kill. And now he's doing a follow-up and he's speaking to the families of victims. When he and I spoke, I had said, Megan had a lot of trauma in her life and the work on the trauma was hard. So instead of working on herself and her own trauma, she gravitated towards people that she wanted to try and help fix. And he said that was a common denominator that he was hearing from many families of victims. That was a common thread, he said, in a lot of his interviews. Every single guy she dated abused her. The irony in it is that she just wanted to find someone to love her, someone she could have a family with.
Megan met and began a relationship with her abuser about a year and a half prior to her murder.
She met him in 2019 or 2020. I believe they met at a bar. I never met him. The first time I saw him in person was the day he was arraigned. In about August of 2020, they had signed a lease on an apartment together. I don't know before the signing of the lease if there was physical violence, but shortly after the signing of the lease, before they moved in together, it got physical. That's when he assaulted her, for what I know to be the first time. She filed a police report in the town of Cohey's, but they sent it over to Albany for something with jurisdictions. So Albany issued a warrant for his arrest. At the time, she moved into her own apartment in the fall of 2020. In New York State, there's a statute that gives a guideline for prosecutions, and you have to prosecute cases within a certain amount of time. When a warrant gets issued, the clock starts to run. And by the time he turned himself in, the time to prosecute the case had pretty much run. They couldn't get in touch with her. It was indicated to me based on a conversation I had that they probably just sent a letter, but they sent it to the address where he assaulted her at, which she's not there. She left. he had moved in and he wouldn't leave. And in New York, once somebody's living somewhere, it's very hard to get them out. So she walked away from everything, left the apartment, left a car they owned together, and left behind her puppy that he had bought in her. By the time there was another incident in October of 2020, she didn't call the police because at this point, her exact words, the police aren't going to do anything. She lived in a second story apartment over a storefront. So the only way into her apartment really was through the front. There was like a rooftop access and she had a door, but there was no way to get to the second floor. So I have no idea how he got into this apartment and she didn't either. He broke in and he beat her and threatened if she screamed, he was going to kill her and all these things. And she never reported that. That incident, she disclosed to me some things that happened. But after speaking with one of her friends, after she died, she didn't disclose everything to me. She admitted the length of time that he held her against her will. She indicated to me that maybe it was a day, and she indicated to one of her friends that it was a couple of days. In February of 21, they were together at this point again. They dismissed the case to a disorderly conduct. It was just a precursor of other things to come. I've had people ask me if I was mad at God, and I said no, because God can't be everywhere. God knew my daughter was tired. 4 months before she died, we were on the phone as she was walking to the hospital to check herself in. She talked about suicide. I think God just knew something worse was going to happen. And I don't know what could be worse than what happened to her, but he knew it was time, and he just welcomed her with open arms. That child went through so much. And at the end of the day, she never once stopped believing in love and happily ever after. She left him in July of 21 and moved down to Long Island, moved into my mother's house. My mother was not there. She was in a rehab because she had fallen. So Megan was there. Her friends were staying with her in and out. She got a job as a bartender at a local bar. She was enjoying life. And then he moved down in September. He came down in the car that they had co-owned and brought the puppy. Basically, I think what happened was that his money ran out. He came into some claim and got a small settlement and spent that. So he came down and he was staying with her a little bit, couch surfing. He would show up at her job. She had concerns. She never shared them with me. I did find out recently, shortly before he killed her, he had threatened to stab her in the face to make her ugly and no one would ever look at her. Her grandmother was being discharged, was going to be coming home. He needed to leave. None of her friends could stay at the house anymore. She had to get it in order. It was disgusting. Nobody really kept up with the house. She had texted me that morning that she needed my help. He needed to leave. He wouldn't leave. And she didn't want to get the police involved. And I had told her, if he's not going to leave, you have to get the police involved. There's nothing I can do. You're going to physically have him removed from the home. And then I spoke to her that afternoon at 3:35. I called to check and see what was going on. He told her he had nowhere to go. He had no money. She really stood her ground. And like, that was a you problem, not a me problem. He said something about robbing a drugstore and death by cop if he had to. Again, she stood her grounds. She was going shopping with her friend. So she said she was going to call me later. And I said, shoot me a text first because I'm going out to dinner. My husband and my son were away. My other daughter was away looking at college in Florida and visiting her boyfriend's family. And my other daughter was at work. So I was going out to dinner with some friends. We ended the calls with I love yous. I set my alarm for 5 o'clock. I laid down like 4:15 for a little nap. I jumped off the couch at 4:50, literally jumped up like something woke me up. And I thought it was my alarm and it wasn't. I jumped off the couch at 4:50, literally jumped up like something woke me up. And I thought it was my alarm and it wasn't. I'm getting dressed to go out and I see my friend called me and I didn't answer the phone. She lived across the street from my mother and my daughter. I hadn't heard from her in a while, and I thought maybe she was just calling to tell me some drama with my mom, because now my mom was coming home and I didn't want to hear it. I was going out. Moments later, I get a phone call from the hospital. They had somebody that they were able to identify as Megan, and I'm listed as her emergency contact, and they need me to come in the hospital. She's been in an accident. In my head, I'm like, she doesn't have a driver's license. She's driving my mother's car. This is going to be a problem. I'm like, what type of accident? A car accident? And they were like, no, she's been stabbed and that I need to come to the hospital. I immediately call my friend back who had called me before. And I'm like, what's going on? The hospital just called me. She said that she was over across the street with the police. It was a crime scene and that he had stabbed her and he had run. They didn't know where he was. They were looking for him. Did I have any pictures to send? So they have a picture of him. I grab my purse and I'm like, let me get a charger because I'm probably going to be here. My phone might die. Just trying to think practical because I didn't think she was dead. She's been stabbed. We're going to have to figure this out. Depending on the severity, maybe she's going to have to come home. So I get in the car and I call my girlfriends that I'm going out with. I can't come. Megan's at the hospital. She's been stabbed. They're like, do you want us to come? And I was like, no, this is Megan. It'll be fine. I call my friend again and I find a picture and I send it over. She's got me on speaker. And I said, I don't understand. She's in the critical care unit. Where was she stabbed? The police officer was like, I think her hand. And I'm like, well, that's weird. I get to the hospital. I'm sitting in this room waiting. And now my husband's texted me and he's like, what are you doing? It's like very bad service where they were. So I get like a once a day check-in. And I'm like, shit, do I tell him? Do I not tell him? But I have nothing to tell him. So what if I tell him and it's nothing and he's panicking for nothing? But if I don't tell him and it's something bad, then he's going to be mad at me for not telling him. So I just respond. I'm up at Stony Brook. Megan's been stabbed. I don't know anything else. And he calls me. He's like, what do you mean you don't know anything else? Who's with you? Where are you? And I'm like, I'm in this room. True hospital style. They came and they took all her personal information for medical billing. And then they left. He's like, you need to go find someone. Someone needs to talk to you. I think I'd been there maybe about an hour. I'm like, it's not like that now because of COVID. Everything's restricted. You can't go anywhere. Like you used to be able to go in the hallway, but now there's nowhere to go. I go in the hallway and I see a nurse and I said to her, I'm here. My daughter was brought in. She was stabbed. Nobody's telling me anything. I need some answers. She was just coming on to shift, so she didn't know anything about it. She would try and get someone to come and talk to me. But if no one had come and spoken to me, that means they were working on her. My husband heard everything, so I went inside. He hung up with me, and he must have called his mom and his sister to try and have somebody come with me because I was by myself. But I was fine. In my head, I'm like, all right, they're working on her. This is workable. We'll have to move bedrooms around. We'll have to readjust things. But if she needs to go somewhere, she'll have to come home because she certainly can't stay at my mother's if she's recovering from surgery. There's another gentleman in the room. I guess he's waiting for news too, but he's on his phone talking to people and playing TikToks loud. And in my head, I remember thinking, could you please just stop? And then they came in. It was the surgeon, two nurses, and the detective. The other guy that was in the room looks up in a panic as they're closing the door and they're coming to talk to me. I'm like, he's not with me. He's like, I'm not with her. And they were like, then you need to leave. So he leaves and they come over and they tell me that Megan came in. They said her heart wasn't beating. They tried to resuscitate her. And in my head, I remember thinking, okay, this is still workable. She had gone into cardiac arrest. If she was without oxygen, if she has brain impaired, this is all workable. They were sorry that they did everything that they could, but that she was dead. I said to them, I don't understand. How bad was she stabbed that she died? And they kind of looked at each other and looked back at me, and they told me that it was about 10 times. I remember I had the mask on because she's 2021 COVID masks. I couldn't breathe. So they were like, you can take your mask down. And then I asked to see her. They looked at each other and they looked at the detective. The detective choked up and said that he had children too, and that I did not want to see her like that. And I didn't have that breakdown that you see on TV, the wailing mom. I'm like, I have to call my husband. He's trying to find his sister to get his sister to come to the hospital. And I call my two friends that I was supposed to go to dinner with. And I'm like, guys, I need you after all. Megan's dead. So they came up. I texted my siblings, two of them, Patrick, because he's a doctor, and Karen, because she's a critical care nurse. And I'm like, I need one of you to call me. It's bad. It's about Megan. Patrick called me and I told him, and he took care of letting everybody else know. It dawned upon me that I had to call my boss. I had to tell work because I work for the prosecutor. So I remember calling my boss. He's like, is everything okay? And I'm like, no. And I told him. My friends drove me home a couple hours later. It took time. My head was killing me. It hurt so bad. And I knew it was my blood pressure because it was such a stressful thing. And my friend was like, let's have them check you. And I remember like, no, it's probably stroke level high and they're going to make me admit it and I have to go home. Then I had to tell my kids. My one daughter came home from work. I said, I need to talk to you. It's not good. She thought it was that my mother had died. I sat down and I told her, and now I have another child in Florida who's down there with her boyfriend visiting his family and looking at a school. And she was the last one to see her. She was the one who spoke with her sister the most. I called and I told her boyfriend's parents. I said, but I'm just going to call her in the morning. I just want her to have one last night of happiness before I shatter her world. And then she called back. She's like, she knows something's wrong. You have to tell her. So I did. My husband's in Wyoming. They're on top of a mountain. And he tells the guy, we got to go. My child was murdered. We got to go. And they get down. My son was 15 at the time. And he had to tell him. He said that his response was one of denial. He's like, shut up, you're lying. I think he had just told him that Megan had died. And didn't say anything about how. He's like, I'm not lying. She was stabbed to death. And I feel bad because that just shattered their whole childhood. That just changed everything for them.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
They found him on the bus in Chinatown. He was looking to flee, to go down south. I remember he made a comment that he wasn't fleeing. He was going on a much needed vacation. The judge was disgusted and enraged. I had this urge to throw back at him what he said at sentencing. So they're walking him out of the courtroom, and I said to him, enjoy your vacation. And he was all mad, and he's like, I will. I remember in my head, I thought, oh, my daughter never told you about what I'll do for my kids. So I said it again, enjoy your vacation. I see it's pushing a button. And he's like, I will, I'll be back. And they're pushing him through the door, and I said it again. And then they closed the door.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.